ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. You might have noticed that the podcast took a bit of an impromptu hiatus, mostly stemming from a scheduling snafu that saw me lose a podcast episode in post-production while simultaneously preparing this one. But thankfully we are back, and kicking off the month, I'm talking to Goodnight Maryland host Nina Bosky in this birthday episode devoted to the blonde bombshell herself, Marilyn Monroe.
Fame? It's my caviar. Good to have caviar, but we had it every damn day, you know? And you had too much caviar. And yet, it stirs up envy, saying, who does she think she is, Marilyn Monroe?
It's near impossible to cover every facet of Marilyn's life, which has been discussed ad nauseum in countless biographies, biopics, and podcasts. Odds are, if you've read anything about Marilyn Monroe, you can probably fast forward through a lot of this. I won't judge you. Before she was Marilyn Monroe, she was Norma Jean Mortensen, born June 1st, 1926 in Los Angeles. Her mother, Gladys, was a former flapper and worked as a film cutter at Consolidated Film Industries. Marilyn was the last of three children. Her mother suffered through two volatile marriages, though neither man fathered Marilyn herself. She never knew who her real father was, and the stigma of illegitimacy left Monroe with long-term, crippling abandonment issues. As a little girl, she was placed with foster parents Ida and Albert Bolander in Hawthorne, California. Monroe charted many of her happiest times in life to living with the Bolanders, who wanted to adopt her. But, as would happen several times in the young Norma Jean's life, it wasn't to be. Her mother returned and took her back to Hollywood before being committed to a mental hospital, the first of many stays in Gladys's life. Norma Jean was shuttled between foster parents and an orphanage. In the hopes of lifting her out of poverty, her foster mother Grace McKee arranged for the 16-year-old Norma Jean to marry a neighbor boy, 21-year-old factory worker Jim Dougherty. When Jim went overseas, Norma Jean spent her days in a factory, where she was discovered by a photographer. She took quickly to modeling, against her husband and in-law's wishes, and was soon signed to 20th Century Fox, transforming herself from Norma Jean to Marilyn Monroe.
Aww. Eve.
Good evening, Mr. DeWitt. Addison, I've been wanting you to meet Eve for the longest time.
It could only have been your natural timidity that kept you from mentioning it.
You've heard of her great interest in the theater.
We have that in common.
Then you two must have a long talk. I'm afraid Mr. DeWitt would find me boring before too long.
You won't bore him, honey. You won't even get a chance to talk.
Claudia, come here. You see that man? That's Max Fabian, the producer. Now, go and do yourself some good.
Why do they always look like unhappy rabbits?
Because that's what they are. Now, go and make him happy.
The newly minted Marilyn Monroe saw some negligible roles in mediocre films. When she wasn't filming, she was honing her craft by taking dance, voice, and acting lessons. She was obsessed with becoming a better actress, and would work with the likes of Lee Strasberg and a host of other acting coaches throughout her life. Finally, in 1950, Fox figured out where to put Marilyn, casting her as an ensemble performer in John Huston's The Asphalt Jungle and the Betty Davis star All About Eve. She wasn't a success overnight and continued to appear in low-budget films throughout the early 50s, which are fun if only from a curiosity standpoint. Monroe's beauty, networking, and modeling propelled her into being one of the studio's most popular stars in spite of her middling film work. Hedda Hopper said of her in 1952 that Marilyn Monroe was the, quote, cheesecake queen turned box office smash. After a star turned in 1952's Don't Bother to Knock, a film I cannot recommend more highly for Marilyn's unique performance, she became a full-fledged leading lady in 1953's Niagara. Starring as the villainous wife of Joseph Cotton, Monroe's Niagara performance was so provocative that women's clubs protested the feature, and this actually only aided in its popularity, and from then on, she really was a box office smash.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
By the time Monroe had starred in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and How to Marry a Millionaire, she became one of the top money-making stars of the year. Unfortunately, Monroe wasn't happy with Fox's disinterest in taking her seriously. She wanted to star in other genres and not just stick to comedies and musicals, and her salary had remained the same since 1950, a bit of a contradiction with that top money-making star persona. She was suspended from Fox in 1954 after refusing to star in the film The Girl in Pink Tights. Marilyn was usually keenly aware of what movies were going to help her career and which were just reliant on her looks. And Girl in Pink Tights is often considered not worthy of her talents, or anybody's really. This allowed her the chance to marry Joe DiMaggio, the second of three marriages that she would engage in, the last being with playwright Arthur Miller. Marilyn soon secured a raise and the starring role in the Broadway smash The 7 Year Itch, which was being adapted to film. This is the movie that infamously blended Marilyn Monroe's skirt with a subway grate. But she was still unhappy and desperate to assert herself in her own career. She founded her own production company called Marilyn Monroe Productions, walked away from her contract, and moved to New York to study acting. The studio gave in once again because she was still very popular, and she resumed work on the game-changing Bus Stop in 1956. This movie is often cited as her best performance. She'd end the 1950s with her funniest film, Some Like It Hot, a movie that, despite being one of the greatest screen comedies of all time, gets kind of a bad rap, mostly from director Billy Wilder and star Tony Curtis, who did not have the nicest things to say about Marilyn after her death. In her personal life, she struggled to have a child, and a series of miscarriages ended up putting a strain on her relationship to Arthur Miller towards the end of the decade.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine thin and hatty, I just adore his asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy.
The Hollywood landscape was changing with the advent of the 1960s, and it was evident that Marilyn was struggling to adapt. Her first film of the decade, Let's Make Love, was riddled with production problems, and reviewers for once weren't kind to her performance. Her final completed film saw her returning to the director who aided in her stardom in the 50s, John Huston. The Misfits saw Marilyn teamed opposite Clark Gable and Montgomery Clift, and in a way, their appearance acts as the death knell for both the three stars' careers and the studio system in general. Misfits is a very melancholy movie, and it's often hard to watch knowing the fates of all three stars. Gable passed away soon after filming Wrapped, and Marilyn and Montgomery Clift followed shortly after. The shoot was difficult, and Marilyn spent several months after cameras rolled, attending to health problems and getting a divorce from Arthur Miller. She returned to the studio in 1962 to star in a remake of My Favorite Wife. The film, entitled Something's Gotta Give, would have paired her against Dean Martin and Sid Charisse. Considering how much I love both Marilyn and Sid Charisse, this is one of the movies that I always wonder what could have been. Monroe's untimely death halted production on that film. It would be released in 1963 as Move Over Darling, starring Doris Day in the Marilyn part and James Garner in the Dean Martin part. If you enjoy My Favorite Wife, then you'll probably enjoy this, even though, again, Monroe's performance would have been vastly different from Doris Day's, I'm sure. Marilyn Monroe died in the early morning hours of August 5th, 1962, of a presumed drug overdose. The theories surrounding her demise are many and varied, ranging from the tragically authentic to the bizarrely convoluted. She was just 36. Thankfully, her work is one of the more accessible, considering her time under the studio system. Several classic film stars that I enjoy just don't have their movies released by the studios today, so it's amazing to think that Marilyn's work has transitioned from VHS to probably Laserdisc to DVD and Blu-ray, and now streaming. Everyone has their favorite Marilyn film, and her death should never overshadow the amazing work that she did in her lifetime. When I come back, I'll be joined by Nina Boesky to talk about Monroe's life and legacy.
I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone, boop boop be doo.
the desire to make you my own. I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you, but deedly 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 dum, boop boopy doop.
So our main discussion this week, we are of course honoring the luminous Marilyn Monroe, and I am so fortunate to have the amazing Nina Bosky here from the Goodnight Marilyn podcast. Nina, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I'm a fan of the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what's the amazing work you're doing with Goodnight Marilyn?
I come from a media and general media background, and then I grew into what is now the transformational space. I'm kind of, like I say, a combo special. So I have a company called Life Bites Global, where we do life, business, and media coaching. And I was doing a television show around Life Bites about 5 years ago now. It was a book at the time. And one of my clients had said to me, Nina, I've got this great book. He has an author. It's around Marilyn Monroe. And at that point, I was having, you know, like yourself, you have a guest on an hour. At that point, I think I had 4 or 5 guests per hour. So I was getting all these books being sent to me, and I was like, yeah, I'll read it. I'll read it, and I'll meet with him, and just wanted me to meet with him to see how he can get some media publicity. I got the book, and I thought, I'm going to power read through this. And what ended up happening is I ended up reading it from start to finish in just a few hours. And I thought to myself, wow, this should be a movie. This shouldn't be just a book. This should be a movie. And I didn't know a lot about Marilyn Monroe. When I met with him, he said, well, I actually have a script, and it was optioned a while back from HBO, and they decided to go with the biopic version. That's how it all began. And Goodnight Marilyn, interesting enough, although Marilyn is the driving force behind it, it's not a biopic. It blends fact and fiction. People ask me to describe it, and I said it's a cross between La La Land, a more contemporary, and a L.A. Confidential. So it's got the ultimate thrill ride for people. The thing I don't want to do is, you know, have people misunderstand it is not a biopic of Marilyn Monroe, although it does follow a lot of the last 3 days of her life and what we know did happen during those last 3 days.
You referred to one of my favorite movies, which is L.A. Confidential. Anything that throws that in there is worthy. It's great that you bring up it's not a biopic, because Marilyn is probably one of the most biopic type of figures that we've seen. And I don't know if you've seen any of the biopics that have been made about her life, but there's a lot of really bad ones.
Yes. And I think that going into this, I didn't know a lot about Marilyn Monroe. People say, oh, I've been a huge fan of Marilyn's. And I was, no, I didn't dislike her. I didn't love her like some people just, oh my gosh, I love her. But I've come to love her. And how you do that is once you start understanding who she is, the complexities of who she was as a person, you start to identify. And I think that's one of the things that really bring people into the Marilyn phenomena, really, because she's probably more popular today than she was back in 1962. And she was really popular back then, right? When people asked me about the movie, I got into it. And as I started getting into the movie version of it and realizing, wait a minute here, what's true and what's not, what ended up happening is we started a global radio show, which is the Goodnight Marilyn radio show. And at that point, because my background is media, is I thought, okay, we'll utilize this to promote the movie. What ended up happening is I started looking into what really happened to Marilyn Monroe and really looking at the history behind it. And we started forming a real life investigation team. And I have to say, hands down, it's one of the most renowned, credible, from the Marilyn experts that are on the team to people in their respectful fields. We have Dr. Michael Batten, Dr. Cyril Weck on the forensic pathology. We have a guy named Sal LaBavera, who recently retired to the LAPD. We have criminal and suicide experts, Gary Vitaco Robles, who's probably one of the most credible Marilyn bio authors out there, is also a licensed mental health professional. So you start bringing in some of these Marilyn experts that have known Marilyn for 20, 30 years, and then you start bringing in the experts that are renowned in their own field. And we really made a dedicated effort to dispel fact from fiction, probable theory from Outlandish Rumor, and I went in there thinking one thing, and I'm starting to really believe some of the facts that are really starting to show how Marilyn not only died, we may never know how she died, but we're really starting to have an understanding of specifically what did not happen to her. And, you know, when you look at Marilyn's legacy, one of the things that I'd like to do, because the movie is an entertainment, it'll provoke thought and people asking, well, what really did happen to her? And one of my goals and passions and missions is to really show and display for the public for the first time, really the rumors, and put it into our consciousness, our cultural consciousness, without really having the facts. Oh, she was killed. Oh, it was the Kennedys. Oh, it was the mob. And yet we don't really have any of the facts. And if we can bring that to the table and really dispel some of the outrageous rumors out there, that would really, in my opinion, give a lot to her legacy.
It's remarkable how I've read so many books about her life. She's, again, much like biopic, she's probably one of the stars that has the most amount of written information about her in terms of being an old Hollywood figure. And everybody's got their theory. It's the shock value of throwing out something crazy. I'm not going to name certain authors. They know who they are, and I've written about how awful their work is. It's amazing how everybody has a different theory. And in a lot of cases, there is compelling evidence for most of them. Was there a piece of information or something new that you discovered for yourself?
Yeah, there is. And this has to do probably with the passion that I'm in. So entertainment is in my tradition, but transformation is probably where I reside. So I look at this story and I go, if you talk about Marilyn Monroe, there's always, oh, she's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. And I say this on the air a lot. Well, how can you change tragedy into transformation? There has to be a healing. There has to be a truth. And one of the truths that we do know is around her pathology and her mental health. And it's never talked about that she was given 900 pills 2 months before she died. She was prescribed 900 pills. 700 of them were sleeping pills. And you never hear about that.
Yeah, you hear about the table being littered with pill bottles and stuff, but you never actually hear about the actual sheer number amount.
And you also then tie that into today's society. We haven't really grown that much in regards to the education and the healing of prescription drugs with addiction. And then you put in the context of mental illness. And so one of my big missions with this and the investigation is to bring more awareness to the stigma of mental health, because a lot of people that have mental health issues also have addictions. They find a way of numbing and self-medicating. And Marilyn was probably no different. But the key here is if you look at the aspects of Marilyn and how much she achieved given her life and how much fragmentation she came from, and if you think about the ultimate visualization, she was a visualizer. She could put her mind on something and actually materialize it. So she actually created so much and manifested so much in her life. So if you could take her life and say somebody that maybe is not exactly what Marilyn had in terms of a mental disorder and mental health issues, but take that and say, wow, if Marilyn could achieve what she achieved, and if she had the proper diagnosis and the proper medication. You also have to think it was 1962. So they were limited in terms of how they knew. And back then, everybody was giving pills. So the context of 1962 to 2017 is very different. But one of the big things here is if we can give a lack of stigma and get somebody to get the proper help that they need, one, they can get off the addiction, and two, they can actually get the mental health that they really need to be able to improve their life. Now, that would be a legacy that I know Marilyn, given her humanitarian efforts and how much she really cared, would be a wonderful legacy to leave her star and her humanness for those of us that are still really adoring her and are getting the benefit of Marilyn, even though she's not here physically on this earth, but with us in spirit.
Well, you bring up a great point that so much of the Hollywood industry, and really in terms of how we medicate people, hasn't changed. It's just certain stars were better at hiding it. Marilyn, I bolted not only because she was beautiful and still successful, but because she died relatively young, she's up there with James Dean's figures of the world, whereas you hear stories about stars who always medicated, whether it was alcohol, you know, Veronica Lake, there were rumors that she was mentally ill and was a notorious drunk. Betty Davis, Joan Crawford definitely were drinkers in their spare time. So it's interesting how Marilyn gets elevated, but she suffered from a lot of the same issues in terms of coping mechanisms that pretty much every star, and I think a lot of stars continue to do today. It's just she happened to die at the right time, which sounds horrible, but that helps in terms of why people recall her so well.
In terms of the stars, you know, yes, I'll put it into context of back in the 20s, 30s, 40s,
right.
50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all that time, we weren't talking about those issues. Now, Marilyn actually was one of the few stars that actually did talk about her childhood. She didn't candy coat it. And I think that's what made her so relatable as well, is that she wasn't trying to put on an air that she was something than she was when she was talking about her real life. She would talk about her abuse. She would talk about some of her legacy in terms of her family history. But one of the things, too, is that today we have the resources. We have the ability to get help. Back then, if you went to the doctor were giving you these pills. Today, the doctor's giving you those pills, but they know better as well. And actually, even back then, they knew better. One of the things that most people don't realize is that Marilyn died with the mixture of two, actually, types of medications in her system, Nebutal and chlorhydrate. It was a combination of those two drugs that actually killed her. You have Dr. Engelberg, who went on record saying that he never prescribed chlorhydrate, and yet we have those prescriptions that are basically saying that he did. So they did know better not to be able to prescribe those drugs, and the doctors, if they were in today's standards, would actually be brought up on criminal charges. So it's 1962 is different than 2017, but if you look at the context of what they were prescribing her, they knew better as doctors. And as you said, a lot of these stars were giving these drugs back then. And it's one of those things, like Michael Jackson's doctor, is that the celebrity says, well, you're not going to give it to me. I'm going to go over there and get it from somebody else. And that becomes the challenge as well. So it's a complex problem, but it's one that I think that if we start to shed some light on it and we start to give people resources and the ability to get the help, then you could start to combine the combination of addiction and mental illness that really does go hand in hand a lot of the time. And we could start really fixing the problem at the root issue. So those are one of the things that I'd love to see the movie come out that is just wonderful about these two young up-and-coming hopefuls. Very similar to La La Land in terms of the characters, and they're wanting to make it in life. And Marilyn was the ultimate dreamer, where the LA Confidential type of theme comes in is everybody in this film dream is getting threatened. And it really asks the question to the audience, because we all have dreams, whether we're in Hollywood or not. The question is, how far would you go to have your dream come true? That's really fun. So the movie is really powerful from that perspective. And then it will ask, it'll get people talking, well, what actually did happen to her? And then I would love for us to really dispel a lot of the rumors out there that are just not true. And that we know that aren't true. So at least we might not ever know exactly what happened to her, but we can at least be able to share with the public, the world public, what we know didn't happen to her. And that would be really powerful.
You brought up the persona, and I think what's been wonderful to see with so many books and podcasts written and verbal correspondence about her that's come out, most people, in you know, I'm a big proponent of promoting more women in cinema.
That's a passion of mine. So I love your mission.
And Marilyn really got, and she still like gets flack with all the stupid memes that are grossly attributed to her, quotes from her that aren't quotes from her, but the assumption that she was stupid, that her movies promoted this crazy dumb blonde that we see even nowadays. I've talked to people who say Marilyn Monroe set feminism back, and when you read more about her and learn more about her, the fact that she tried to read a book a day, was reading philosophy, and she was incredibly intelligent. And I read biographies that have alleged, and I don't know if it's necessarily true, that part of her frustration and anxiety stemmed from the fact that she wanted to be taken seriously and have more control of her career, and was just pigeonholed into being the sex pot. And that's not what she wanted. It's been amazing to see so many people reevaluate her films, and I've been seeing it them myself, and noticing how subversive a lot of her performances are to promote a somewhat more feminist agenda in the very strict confines of the filmmaking style that she was working in.
Well, it's a very good point you bring up, and I alluded to the Marilyn experts, and if they were listening right now, they'd probably be like, yes, somebody's talking about this. Leslie Caspar with Mary Jane Grey and April Villavia, who are three of really honoring Marilyn's legacy, and one of the things that they are most proud of, really, and it's something that on the outside, when you just are just on the peripheral of looking at how she played that role so well, which is the ditzy comedic blonde, right? That was acting. That wasn't necessarily who she was. And people think that that's who she was in real life. And I think that was where it was the very thing that she created was actually ending up being the prisoner of as well. But she was one of the most trained. She worked extremely hard on her acting, her dancing, her singing. She spent hours and hours and hours wanting to be better. That was one of the reasons. If you look at who she was at the height of her career, here she is in the 1950s, the height of her career, she walked away from Fox and went to New York to study to become a better actor. I wouldn't say to become a dramatic actress, but to be a better actor. And if you think of the courage that it took at that time, when you're at the height of your stardom, to go, you know what, I'm going to go do what is my truth, which is I'm going to become a better actor or actress. That's going to really be where I want to spend my time. That takes a lot of guts to be able to walk away from that. And she was, and she came back on her own terms. She was able to come back and regroup and to be stronger of it. And so when people look at her and they go, oh, she played that ditzy blonde, that's just who she was, that really wasn't who she was. She was very different from the Marilyn Monroe caricature that she created. And that was fortunate and unfortunate at the same time, because she couldn't get away from that character.
It's the ultimate definition of persona to me. You know, we assume persona is being able to separate public and private life. And really, for her, people just naturally assumed that it was always had to be one and the same. It couldn't be two separate things. I love when, well, I say love in a facetious sense, but there was a period of time after she married Arthur Miller and she went to the country. There's pictures of him and her out in this country setting, which is one of my favorite photos of her of all time. And when she came back to work, people said that the studio said that she was fat. And you look at those pictures, I still sit there and I say, honestly, how can you say that? I mean, we don't have the studio system in the sense that we did back in the 50s, but have the executives really changed?
No.
No.
And women are always put into a different standard than men as it relates to their looks. And I think that's a huge challenge. And one of the things also I was going to mention is that if you think back in the studio system, the only difference I would say today is that women know how to access their power on their own. But back in Marilyn's time, if you think about it, she was actually really smart, because what she did is she accessed the power through men. Back then, that's what you had to do in order to get ahead. Now, not saying that's right or wrong, but back at that time, that's how you had to get ahead. You had to access your power through men. And so she was able to do that in a way that allowed her to benefit from it. Today, because of Marilyn, Marilyn was only Cecil Ball, Mary Pickford. There wasn't very many people at that time. Remember what I said to you is that she turned away from the studio system. So she initially, when she was younger, accessed her power through men, but then turned around and said, you know what? I want to be able to start my own production company. I want to be able to do things on my own terms. So back in the 1960s, women weren't actually able to do that as readily as they are today. So she was really a complex character, because on one hand, she played men. On the flip side of it, she had enough strength and enough courage to be able to stand on her own and say, I want to do it differently.
I actually just finished a biography about Hedy Lamarr. I saw a lot of parallels in the fact that neither of their respective studios knew really what to do with them, stuff them in stuff that they assumed was going to work, and both women, incredibly intelligent figures. Hedy Lamarr especially is seeing a second life in terms of the accomplishments outside of her film. So for me, it's scary how much of a dialectic female actresses are connected to each other, just in terms of being both inspiring each other and being marginalized by the grander studio system. We're talking so much about Marilyn and the films. I want to talk about a couple specific films. What are the ones, you have ones that just you recommend? There's some favorite Marilyn films for you.
My all-time favorite, and this is before I even got involved in this project, is Some Like It Hot. It's the three of them, Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and Marilyn Monroe, together, they just created such a powerful, powerful movie. Funny, it stands the test of time. And when you really think about the Marilyn Monroe films, they all stand the test of time. I mean, they really do. So that'd be my number one, and that's just my own personal favorite. But her comedic time in How to Marry a Millionaire, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, The 7-Year Itch, they were kind of in that same genre from 53 to 7-Year Itch was 55, right?
Yeah.
And Like It Hot was later. And then one of my probably favorite films of hers is Bus Stop. I love Bus Stop. I think Bus Stop is acting-wise, she's superb, but also you really get to see her vulnerability, and I think that's really, really key. Some of the other films like Key Business and All About Eve, those films, it's interesting. She stands out. That's the thing about her. She might have one or two lines, but she stands out in the film.
Even in something like earlier films that are just not good. Something like, oh, Henry's Full House, I think is fun, even though she's got about one scene in it. She does stand out. She's in period garb.
Yes.
Love Nest, I think, is the one. Love Nest is not a good movie, but she's good in it. Even some of those really weird early movies, she makes herself known and is able to...
You Were Meant For Me, into the chorus.
We're Not Married is another one. That it's a fun movie, but it's not great. But she's really good in it. For me, the ones I like, Some Like It Hot is fantastic, even though Tony Curtis had some less than favorable things to say about Marilyn after the fact.
Can I also say, and I'm sure you already know this, that is a total rumor from Tony Curtis. It is not substantiated at all. Marilyn, he claims that they were having an affair on the set of Some Like It Hot. And that is absolutely not true. She was actually pregnant at the time.
He had also said that she was unprofessional and that he didn't like working with her. And I also really like Don't Bother to Knock. It's Richard Widmark. That's who I kept thinking. I kept wanting to
Richard Widmark.
I think she's fantastic in that role. You feel her vulnerability. You feel bad for the character that could have just been a one-note raging psychopath. I think she's fantastic in that one. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, I always throw out there. People are looking for positive depictions of women. Probably my favorite film about female friendship. It's supposed to be a romance, but I don't ever see it as a romance because you really don't care if they get the guys at the end. You care that they're friends throughout the end of it.
Goes back to her comedic timing. Some of those lines that she delivered are just, you'd have to be a skilled actress to be able to deliver them with that kind of timing.
Yeah.
And not everybody could.
What's the future hold? Goodnight Marilyn is now a film. What's the process now for people who might want to learn more about it and see it? How?
So we are supposed to be going into production at the end of August, early September. Cross your fingers that all is well. The movie making, I've always been on the other side of movie making, which is marketing. And so you already have a budget. You're all ready to go. We have come close in the last 2 years to be able to get to a place of production, and then somebody falls out, something happens, etc. Now I know why movies take so long to get made. But we are now looking to, it will either start the week before Labor Day or we'll start right after Labor Day, depending if all the elements can get in place in time. But they can go to goodnightmarilyn.com, and there is the investigation team, you to the Goodnight Marilyn radio shows. I would certainly recommend that for people who have not really looked into Marilyn. We talk about her life as it relates to some of the Hollywood figures, some of the photographers that have worked with her. Dina Martin was with us, Dean Martin's daughter. So part of the challenge with remembering Marilyn and people that knew her is, and this year it'll be 55 years since her passing. So part of it is finding those people that knew her or understand her. And then, of course, the investigation, which is one of the things that I would say for everybody, and this is bigger than Marilyn Monroe. We live in a time in the society and media where stories go around in 2 minutes. I can be global. And we've got to start to ask ourselves, is this the truth? And where are they getting their facts? Because people will say things out there as if they know. And the reality is it may not be the truth. And that certainly is the case for Marilyn Monroe. But I think we're living in a society now where media can make something appear to be true when, in fact, there is no facts to substantiate it. And I think we should all take this as a note to go, wow, is this the truth?
And just in case people want to check out social media, you guys have Goodnight Marilyn Twitter as well.
So we have Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is GN Marilyn, GN like Goodnight Marilyn, GN Marilyn. And that's Twitter. And then Facebook is facebook.com/GoodnightMarilyn. The Goodnight Marilyn Facebook page is where the most active. And then, of course, Twitter, because it's connected to it as well. So I really appreciate it. With the movie coming out, as well as the investigation, we're really wanting them to kind of go hand in hand, because I think the movie will be fun. It'll have something for everybody. And I think you'll be able to identify with. There's probably going to be at least one character that you'll identify with in this movie, in terms of how far you would go for your to allow your dreams to come true.
Well, I am excited to see it. I cannot wait.
Before we close things out, I'd like to read some of your messages that you've sent me, whether through email or Twitter. I got one from Peter Bryant, at PM Bryant on Twitter, who talked about my Robert Mitchum episode and says, "Great episode. Very useful, as I've only seen two Mitchum films, Crossfire and The Grass is Greener." Peter, thanks so much for leaving me a message. I actually haven't seen The Grass is Greener, so I'm interested in seeing that one. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please help the show out by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz, and any messages that I get that you want me to read, I will, so please feel free to get in touch with me with your classic film memories or thoughts on Marilyn or any of the shows that I've done so far. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. I'd also like to give a sincere thank you to past guest hosts The Vern and William Wend for their generous contributions already. Thank you guys so much. If you're interested in becoming a patron or just want to learn more, you can head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. I'd also like to throw out a quick thank you to author Michelle Morgan. Michelle was gracious enough to sit down for an interview about Marilyn with me, but technical problems ended up ruining the interview and it got sucked into the ether. I hope to have Michelle on again in the future, but in the meantime, I recommend checking out her works on Marilyn Monroe, as well as books she's written about Thelma Todd and Carol Lombard, at her official website, michellemorgan.co.uk. I know I mentioned in the last episode doing a contest, and that is going to happen. Ticklish Business is going to turn 1 year old on the 26th of June, I believe. So I am trying to organize a little something to give back to you amazing listeners who have continued on this journey with me. Listen in next time when guest co-host Joey Magidson joins me to look at the Woody Allen comedy, Annie Hall. Till next time.